Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Charles Haviland, and in the early hours of Monday, the 22nd of January, these are our main stories. Ron DeSantis drops out of the race for the Republican presidential nomination and throws his support behind the frontrunner, Donald Trump.
Trump is superior to the current incumbent, Joe Biden. He has my endorsement because we can't go back to the old Republican guard of yesteryear.
There are bloody scenes in Russian-occupied eastern Ukraine after the city of Donetsk was shelled, leaving 27 people dead. And
I've been painted as a traitor, but I know and I believe my opinions are legitimate. When we start to actually go for peace, when the country will actually start to humanize Palestinians, that's what will bring us security.
We hear from the first Israeli to be jailed for refusing to join the war, as the number of dead in Gaza surpasses 25,000. Also in this podcast, after days of protests against right-wing extremism in Germany, hundreds of thousands take part in the biggest rallies so far, and one huge South Korean export, the boy band BTS, making another kimchi as the cabbage side dish breaks export records. There is no clear path to victory. The parting words of the Florida Governor Ron DeSantis as he dropped out of the 2024 US presidential contest on Sunday afternoon and endorsed his former rival and most high-profile critic, Donald Trump.
If there was anything I could do to produce a favorable outcome, more campaign stops, more interviews, I would do it. But I can't ask our supporters to volunteer their time and donate their resources if we don't have a clear path to victory. Accordingly, I am today suspending my campaign.
The man once seen as the candidate with the best chance of beating Mr. Trump as the Republican Party's nominee for 2024 suffered a 30 percentage point loss to him in last Monday's Iowa caucuses. His withdrawal leaves Nikki Haley as the only rival to the ex-president for the Republican nomination. Our correspondent Naomi Iqbal is in New Hampshire, the state where the next Republican primary will be held on Tuesday. She told me more about why Ron DeSantis decided to drop out.
I think the writing was on the wall for some time for Ron DeSantis. What's interesting about him is that he was the hot ticket after the midterm elections in 2022 when he really smashed it in Florida. Where I am right now, I'm in this seafood fast food restaurant. As news came through that he was dropping out, Nikki Haley turned up here where she was meeting and greeting supporters. She was very complimentary about Ron DeSantis and said that he was a great governor. She wishes him well. But then she said, I quote, it's one fella and one lady left. And she said, let the best woman win. So it's now the two-horse race that she predicted that it would be. And she seems very confident that she can beat Donald Trump for that nomination.
I've seen some news just coming in of the Trump campaign reacting. Have you been able to assess the details of that?
Yeah, so Donald Trump has welcomed the fact that Ron DeSantis has now endorsed him. It's really interesting because, you know, those two were really sniping at each other over the last year or so. Certainly Donald Trump going really hard at Ron DeSantis in the style that he does. He even said that he's going to retire his nickname, Ron DeSanctimonious. Ron DeSantis, I don't even think DeSantis is a word, but he made a point of saying Ron DeSantis is now someone that is on his side. Of course, he'll welcome it. In his eyes, that's one person down and another person to go. So now his eyes are set on Nikki Haley, who he has a lot of nicknames for. And we'll see when the primary happens on Tuesday what the results will be. I should say that the polls show that he is still pretty far ahead. But Nikki Haley and her supporters, certainly I've been spending a lot of time talking to them, are pretty confident that she has what it takes to win the nomination.
Naomi Iqbal in New Hampshire. The war between Ukraine and Russia, prompted by Moscow's invasion, saw two major developments on Sunday. The first was a drone attack at a gas terminal outside St. Petersburg, which caused a huge fire. And then an airstrike in the Russian-occupied city of Donetsk in eastern Ukraine, which Russian officials say killed at least 27 people and wounded 25 in a market district. This report from our Europe regional editor, Danny Eberhardt.
The shelling in Russian-controlled Donetsk hit an area in the southwest of the city, not far from the front line. Graphic video footage from the Reuters news agency shows many dead bodies lying on the snow-covered streets. Valery Tkachuk lost his wife in the shelling.
A woman called from my wife's phone. I was at work. She said, "That's it, your wife's gone. That's all. She traded at the market right here, next to the store. She must have been walking past right here."
Based on the Russian casualty figures, it would appear to be the worst attack on a civilian area in a Russian-occupied part of Ukraine since the conflict began. Donetsk City and parts of the wider region were first seized by Russian-backed fighters in 2014. They've been under Moscow's control ever since. The day had begun with a major fire caused by explosions overnight at a gas terminal in the Russian port of Ust-Luga. The Russian authorities say there were no casualties. They have not confirmed that the plant, owned by the gas producer Novatek, was targeted in a drone attack, but the district was put on high alert. Ukrainian sources have claimed it was. This would fit in with a pattern of Kyiv increasingly targeting Russian infrastructure in reprisal for sustained bombardments of its own critical utilities. Only days ago, Russia claimed it had foiled a Ukrainian drone attack in the same region, reportedly on an oil depot. It was the first time that Ukraine is believed to have targeted an area that far north in this way. The developments will worry Moscow. The port of Ust-Luga is strategically significant. It's the biggest port by tonnage of cargo in the whole Baltic area. Ukraine claims that the hit won't just damage Russia's economy. It'll also hurt fuel supplies for its war effort.
Danny Eberhardt reporting. The Hamas-run government of Gaza says the Israeli offensive has now claimed more than 25,000 lives in the Strip since the group's deadly assault against Israel in October. Meanwhile, in its first public account of the attack, Hamas said it was a necessary step against Israeli occupation, but that some mistakes occurred due to the chaos that followed what it called the rapid collapse of Israel's security system. 130 Israeli and other hostages taken by Hamas are still being held in Gaza. Our correspondent Mark Lowen reports from Jerusalem.
In Gaza, tallies of the dead are out of date by the hour. The latest milestone of more than 25,000 killed, according to the Hamas-run health ministry, comes as Israeli forces focus on southern Gaza, where they are convinced top Hamas commanders are holed up around the city of Khan Yunis. That's where the Israeli Defense Forces say they discovered another tunnel, 830 metres long and booby-trapped, which the IDF spokesman Daniel Hagari said contained cells that they believe were used to keep Israeli hostages.
Each cell was enclosed by metal bars and had a toilet and a mattress. According to testimonies we have, about 20 hostages were held in this tunnel at different times, in difficult conditions, without daylight.
More than 3 months in, most Israelis still back the war, but not their prime minister, whose popularity is sinking. There's anger from families of the hostages, who say Benjamin Netanyahu must do more to get them back. And there's also growing doubts over progress. US intelligence is reported to have concluded that Israel has killed only 20-30% of Hamas fighters, and that the group has enough weapons to continue striking back for months, raising the spectre of a prolonged conflict with deepening trauma on both sides.
Mark Lowen reporting. Well, since the October the 7th attacks and the start of the consequent Israeli offensive in Gaza, more than 500 Israeli soldiers have been killed. Military service is mostly compulsory in Israel. But one young man who's refused the draft is 18-year-old Tal Mitnick. He's the first person to be sent to jail for refusing the call-up for Gaza. He explained why to my colleague Rebecca Kesby.
Came to the decision when I realized I cannot in good conscience take part in the actions of the IDF against Palestinian people. I could not take part in the occupation, and I cannot take part in a body that believes that violence is the way to solve problems.
Well, lots of people listening will say that those attacks by Hamas on October the 7th were the biggest loss of Jewish life in a single day since the Holocaust, and something had to be done to push back against that.
I believe that the attacks were horrible and totally unjustified, and everyone in Israel has lost someone that's close to them. But with this grief, we can't let it turn into a feeling of revenge, and we can't let the army do what Hamas did to us. We can't let more families grieve. It's been pretty bad. I've been painted as a traitor, but I believe my opinions are legitimate. And when we start to actually go for peace, when the country will actually start to humanize Palestinians, that's what will bring us security.
I'm sure there are people listening to you who have a lot of sympathy with your point of view, but others might say it sounds a little bit naive, if I can just say that, saying you want everyone to live because people have already died. And there are some that are saying the very existence of Israel could be at stake and they're trying to defend the country.
I think it's naive to think that violence will solve anything. All the violence that we've seen in these 70 years hasn't solved anything, and it doesn't look like we're changing any policy. We need to change. And the only change that we can see is a change for nonviolence. More violence and more bloodshed isn't going to solve anything.
What is the way forward as you see it?
We need to free all the hostages, bring back all the political prisoners, get to a ceasefire and start talk about a long-lasting solution.
You do face another draft army summons next week, I think. What are you going to do then?
I have a draft order on Monday and I will refuse service once again. All my heart knows that it's the right decision. Conscientious objectors have been remembered as the people who got the countries out of war, if it's in Vietnam or in Israel with the Lebanon war. I feel like with the time, people will see my decision as the right one and I will not change it. I'm fighting so that no one has to risk their life. I think that these people risking their lives are the government sending them off to die for nothing. This won't bring us any security. And we're seeing this with more and more soldiers dying every day and more civilians dying every day. Hamas isn't getting any weaker. And the hostages aren't coming back. So what is the point of this war besides of revenge? I don't know if there's anything that could change my mind.
Tal Mitnick speaking to Rebecca Kesby. Across Germany, Sunday was another day of big demonstrations against the far right, and particularly the right-wing AfD party. Official figures say more than 1 million protesters took part over the weekend in almost 100 cities, mainly motivated by reports that the AfD were discussing a policy of mass deportation of citizens of foreign origin or heritage. These demonstrators in Cologne explained why they were there.
I'm demonstrating against the fact that the things that we all learnt at school, that we all know, can still seem to repeat themselves. And I'm here to show that the silent majority is no longer silent, because we are the majority.
And I think our democracy is a stable democracy, and it must never, never be attacked in the way the AfD is currently attacking it.
In Munich, the numbers gathering were so large that the demo had to be called off for fear of overcrowding. In Berlin, 100,000 people rallied. From the German capital, here's our correspondent, Damian McGuinness.
This large protest outside the Reichstag building in Berlin is just the latest in a wave of demonstrations that have swept the country. It was all sparked by reports last week of a secret meeting in November in which far-right activists, including some members of the AfD, discussed a plan to deport millions of people with non-German backgrounds. This plan has sparked outrage in Germany and brought people to the streets, hundreds of thousands almost every day. And it's also sparked a debate about whether to ban the AfD party. It's really gaining traction. On the one hand, some people say it should happen because there are some elements within the AfD who are clearly anti-democratic. Others say it would be difficult to do, there are high legal hurdles, and it would also play into the AfD's narrative of being victimised by mainstream society. I think what we're seeing here is how polarised German society is.
Our Berlin correspondent, Damian McGuinness. The president of World Football's governing body, FIFA, has called for teams whose fans commit racist abuse to forfeit their games automatically. Gianni Infantino was responding to incidents on Saturday at Sheffield Wednesday in England and at Udinese in Italy, where AC Milan players briefly walked off the pitch in protest. Here's our sports news correspondent Patrick Geary.
Two incidents in two matches in two different countries have highlighted the continuing problem of racism in football. Now the man in charge of the global game has called for changes that would cost teams points if their fans commit racist acts. FIFA president Gianni Infantino posted on X, formerly Twitter, "We have to implement an automatic forfeit for the team whose fans have committed racism and caused the match to be abandoned, as well as worldwide stadium bans and criminal charges for racists." Yesterday, Coventry City's Casey Palmer told the referee in his side's championship game against Sheffield Wednesday that he'd been subjected to racist abuse from the crowd. The game was stopped temporarily and South Yorkshire police are now investigating the incident. Meanwhile, in Udine in Italy, the AC Milan goalkeeper was racially abused by Udinese fans. After speaking to the referee, Mike Maignan and his teammates walked off the field for 10 minutes. The France international says it wasn't the first time it had happened to him.
This thing of racism cannot be allowed to reach this level. And with all the cameras that are there, everything that's there, and the sanctions that are there for these things, something must be done to change things.
Kick It Out has been campaigning against racism in English football for more than 30 years. Troy Townsend from the organisation says he wants Infantino to provide more details about his idea.
I hope that what he does then is to provide the further information behind what he means by forfeit. We've been, as an organisation, an advocate of walking off the field of play from the players and an advocate of deducting points, or else we're just going to be going around in circles with the same conversation time and time again.
The hunt is now on for those who racially abused Palmer and Maignan, but despite the presence of cameras and the potential of consequences, this is a problem that's not going away.
Patrick Geary reporting. Still to come on the Global News Podcast.
It's important that we don't write to get awards. That said, it's a stamp of approval. And when you come to something like the T.S. Eliot Prize, we're not just talking about any award, are we?
We hear from the winner of one of poetry's most prestigious prizes. The White House says it's taking an attack on an airbase in Iraq, shared by US and Iraqi forces, extremely seriously. Washington blames Iran-backed militias for the assault on the Al-Assad base late on Saturday. The White House Deputy National Security Advisor is John Finer.
It was a very serious attack using ballistic missiles that pose a genuine threat. Through the skill of U.S. forces, many, if not most, of those missiles were shot down before they impacted the base, but some of them got through. And the United States has demonstrated in the past, when these attacks have taken place in Iraq and Syria, that we are going to respond and to hold these groups accountable.
Elsewhere in the Middle East, in a village in southern Lebanon, a drone strike believed to have been Israeli is said to have killed two Hezbollah fighters. For more on these attacks, I spoke to our Middle East correspondent, Hugo Bashega, in Beirut.
What we know from the US military is that this base that's being used by US forces in Iraq was hit by ballistic missiles, also by rockets. One Iraqi serviceman was injured. A number of American personnel are now being evaluated for any possible brain injuries. The Americans are saying that this attack was carried out by Iranian-backed militants from inside Iraq. And we've been talking about, you know, attacks that have been carried out by groups supported by Iran, trained and armed by Iran all across the region. And Iraq has become another place where tensions have been high, and it really shows how this conflict that's happening in Gaza is spreading across the region.
What's the latest, indeed, following the apparent Israeli attack earlier in South Lebanon?
One of the main concerns has been the situation along the Lebanon-Israel border and these almost daily cross-border attacks between Hezbollah, which is another group that is supported by Iran, and the Israeli military. And Hezbollah confirmed today that one fighter was killed in what has been described as an Israeli drone attack. And again, I think we've seen the impact that these attacks have had. 80,000 people have been evacuated from communities in northern Israel. A similar number of people have left their villages in southern Lebanon, and there are fears that this could lead to a major confrontation between Hezbollah and Israel, and, you know, the possibility of something very similar that we saw in 2006 when there was a major war between Hezbollah and Israel. You know, all those different groups behind those attacks, Hezbollah here in Lebanon, militias in Iraq, also in Syria, the Houthis in Yemen, who've been attacking commercial vessels in the Red Sea, are supported by Iran. And part of what Iran describes as the axis of resistance, they are trained by Iran, they are armed by Iran, and they say that this is how they are responding to Israel's war against Hamas in Gaza. And the Houthis, Hezbollah, say that these attacks are going to continue until there is a ceasefire in Gaza or the war in Gaza ends.
Hugo Bashega in Beirut. for hundreds of millions of Hindus when India's Prime Minister Narendra Modi opens a new temple this week for one of the faith's most revered deities, it will be a dream come true. However, for many millions of Muslims, it'll be a painful reminder of a grim episode in India's recent past, because that temple was once a mosque, which was illegally torn down, triggering religious violence across the country. Our South Asia correspondent, Yogita Limaye, has travelled to Ayodhya, the site of the new temple. She sent this report.
Hail Lord Ram, a young group of Hindus shout near the site where a grand temple is being opened for one of Hinduism's biggest deities, Lord Ram, at the spot where they believe he was born. This is, for Hindus, one of their most holy places. Rishal Singhvi is a 20-year-old student.
Coming here will be the very biggest achievement of my life. It is so exciting that our God is coming back to his place.
The Prime Minister's presence turns a religious ceremony into a state event, many say, especially controversial because of the dark history of the site.
Some young men got into the mosque itself. They raised the saffron flag. They started destroying the structure.
Until 1992, a 16th-century mosque stood there. Many Hindus believe it was built by a Muslim ruler over the temple at the birthplace of Lord Ram. The mosque was illegally destroyed by tens of thousands of Hindu men climbing on its domes, wielding hammers, swords and tridents. I've now come to meet one of the men who says he was a part of those mobs, Santosh Dubey. In India, he's called a kar sevak or a religious worker.
I feel proud and happy. It was the best thing I have done. It was religious work and I was put on earth to do it. I have no regrets.
Santosh and dozens of others spent time in jail, but they were not convicted. In the violence that broke out following the demolition of the mosque, thousands of people were killed all over India, most of them Muslims. And I've come now to a mosque to meet the son of one man who was killed in the violence. I'm going to speak to Muhammad Shahid to find out what happened to his father.
First he was beaten, and then they poured oil on him and set him on fire. The country wants to forget it, but Muslims can never forget. We were betrayed then, and that's why we are fearful now. So many outsiders will come again. And it's when outsiders come to Ayodhya, the trouble starts.
The member of parliament from Ayodhya belongs to the Bharatiya Janata Party, or the BJP, which is Prime Minister Narendra Modi's party. His name is Lalu Singh. I've come to his office just off a busy street in Ayodhya. I've come here to ask Mr. Singh how appropriate it is for the Prime Minister of a secular country to be opening such a major Hindu religious event.
100%
It's 100% right. This must happen. The culture of the majority community in a country dominates the nation. This does not mean we do not respect minorities. If the Prime Minister is Hindu, why should he not visit the biggest center of the Hindu faith?
The events that have occurred in this city, in Ayodhya, they've shaped Indian politics. All major political parties have sought to appease voters over the issue. But for Prime Minister Narendra Modi's BJP, its support of the temple as part of its aggressive assertion of Hinduism have been the reason that it's transformed from being just a small party a few decades ago to being seen as virtually undefeatable now. And indeed, the inauguration of the temple is the reason why many believe it will sweep elections that will be held later this year. But with it being carried out by the Prime Minister, many are also asking what that means for the future of a secular India.
Yogita Limaye reporting from Ayodhya in northern India's Uttar Pradesh state. Last week, Jason Alan Pezon won the T.S. Eliot Prize, one of poetry's biggest, for his work Self-Portrait as Othello. Jason's story in itself is quite a tale. He was born into poverty in Jamaica to a mother who was studying to be a teacher and a father who left before he was born. He lived with his grandparents, yam farmers, during his early years and learned to read from a blackboard on their veranda. Having completed a degree at the University of the West Indies, Jason's education has taken him to Montreal, Paris and Oxford. He spoke to Johnny Diamond about his work and winning such a prestigious prize.
It's important that we don't write to get awards. That said, awards affect the course of a career. It's a stamp of approval. And when you come to something like the T.S. Eliot Prize, we're not just talking about any award, are we?
You write of your time in Paris at the École Normale Supérieure. I will always be a stranger here. Is that in Paris? Is it Europe? Is it your existence in general?
That here is very much Paris.
I'm going to Paris at last, Mama's grandson, and I cannot sleep tonight. Will I learn to speak here a tongue of loss and forsaking the varnish?
But I suppose these situations evoke a broader context as well. I had just done my first year at Merton College, Oxford, as well. And I was on an odyssey that I was thrilled about. And I suppose I was asking those questions around your belonging to a particular place and the sort of awkwardness that you get when you come from a poor background, coming into these spaces.
One other black man in the room speaks my language, the language of performer. And wow, did they like it, the looks. Trying to find whiteness in my blackness. Come on, brethren, my Jamaican brother says to me. Black people don't go opera. You know this.
And I should stress that you're having a lot of fun. As I think the book shows, it's somebody who comes wide-eyed to a completely new world and who dives into the experience. It's that world of cocktail parties and tweed jackets and black tie dinners and going to the theatre and the opera and what have you. He's enjoying it, but he's also watching himself doing it because you need to sort of like convince yourself that you belong there. It's a performance. I've come a long way on my journey living in Europe as a Jamaican who's come to this space. There have been a lot of great things. I am now an associate professor at a Russell Group University. What I'm saying, Johnny, is that I've changed class and I'm aware of it. I'm no longer a stranger to Europe.
You've recently become a father. I wonder about the world which you have brought a child into, in particular the country you've brought one into. Do you think it is a more welcoming place?
No, Johnny. Sadly, I don't think it's a more welcoming place. We have a term that's been going about ever since I came to this country, which is hostile environment. As far as immigration policies go, I think things have gotten harsher. One might say, okay, somebody like myself can win a prize in 2023. So there I would say there have been advances. I think one of the weird things that happens is that you make a step forward and there is pushback. It's a game of constantly proving that you are just as good as the other guy, always by doing far more, in my experience.
You are speaking to us from Ethiopia, where you went to go and meet your father for the first time, and I understand you have just met him. Can you share with us what that was like?
I had a warm meeting with my father. It was the very first time ever. I felt fortunate to be able to meet him, to meet his wife, his children. And I'm still processing. It's a lot to take in. I suppose I can't say very much more at the moment.
Without wanting to interrupt that process of understanding, do you think you will, in the end, write about this?
I am already writing about it.
Jason Alan Pesson, speaking to Johnny Diamond. For many people here in the UK who watched the last night of The Proms, the annual series of mainly classical music concerts in London, the singing of Rule Britannia is an essential part of the evening. But critics of the 18th century song believe it's antiquated because of its associations with colonialism, slavery and the British Empire. Sekou Kane Mason, the British cellist who found international fame when he performed at the wedding of Prince Harry and Meghan Markle, has told the BBC that Rule Britannia shouldn't be performed anymore at the last night of the Proms. Noor Nanji reports.
The There was fierce criticism in 2020 when it emerged that Rule Britannia would not be sung at the proms. The BBC had blamed the move on COVID-19 restrictions, but later backtracked. Sheku Kanu Mason was a soloist at the last night of the proms last year, but he said he did not stay to hear Rule Britannia being sung. He told BBC Radio 4's Desert Island Discs the song made a lot of people feel uncomfortable and suggested British folk music could replace it at the event. The BBC said the last night festivities were one of the prom's traditions which were loved by people around the world.
Noa Nanji. South Korea's exports of kimchi, the fermented vegetable side dish, set a new record last year. Amid the rising popularity of all things Korean, they rose by 7% to 44,000 tonnes. The mixture of salted cabbage with radish and carrots already had a big fan base across East Asia. But sales have also been on the up elsewhere. So what's been the secret to kimchi's success? Stephanie Prentice explains.
Probably visibility. So there are more Korean films, TV dramas, bands and celebrities represented globally now, leading to a rise of interest in Korean culture. On YouTube, you can see videos of K-pop band BTS making kimchi with differing results.
제가 초등학교 때 5년 동안 김치를 담근 전적이 있습니다.
그렇지.
Those videos have hundreds of thousands of views each, and the reach of kimchi is also easy to see in this latest data. So traditionally, kimchi was exported to other East Asian countries primarily, whereas today, the US, the UK and the Netherlands are in the top five buyers, and in total, exports of kimchi came to around $150 million in 2023. Now, the Korean Ministry of Agriculture, they compiled the data. They also said that exports were up more than 50% since 2015. In a statement, it said this was mainly due to the increased popularity of K-content. Another big factor is that once kimchi got onto people's radars, its health properties were noticed. The fermented quality is said to improve gut health, so it's also seen as riding the wellness and well-being wave as well.
I'm assuming this is part of a general rise in South Korean exports worldwide.
Yes, so Korean culture has been becoming more popular around the world for years now. Many experts actually point to 2012's Gangnam Style as a big driver of what some are calling the Korean wave. We've seen bands like BTS and Blackpink winning at American award shows and selling out worldwide. The success of Parasite, the Korean film which got an Oscar in 2019, that made people much more aware of the film industry there. And of course, Squid Game, the TV series in 2021, became one of Netflix's most popular shows. And now Past Lives, the movie, is being tipped for Oscar success.
Our reporter, Stephanie Prentice. And that's all from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. This edition was mixed by Matt Hewitt, and the producer was Emma Joseph. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Charles Haviland. Until next time, goodbye.